Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to Episode 8 of The Story Studio with your hosts, Luke Condor and Daniel Wilcox. Oh yeah. Here we go. Check it out now.
Welcome to the Story Studio, a podcast where an independent publishing company explores the world of self-publishing, independent art, and the future of storytelling. It's a show for filmmakers, writers, comic book makers, crowdfunders, entrepreneurs, creators, and anyone who can tell stories in the modern world. I am Luke Condor with a K, and I'm joined by
Daniel Wilcox
and our guest
John Locke. Hello.
John Locke, one of the guys from Big Punch Studios. How's it going?
It's going really well. Thank you. Hello to you both. And this is really the highlight of my day. This is wonderful.
Oh, well, fantastic.
That's good to hear. How's the creating going, guys? Anyone working on anything at the minute?
Is this an open question?
Open question.
Yeah, take it away.
Where to begin? We've just wrapped up issue 7 of BPM, which is a quarterly magazine we put out, kind of like a comics anthology. And yeah, incredibly, we're coming up on 2 years of having done this now. When we said we were doing it, they laughed, but somehow we've made it through nearly 2 years. And yeah, that's just gone to print this week, like a well-oiled machine, kind of. Now it only took us 7 issues, and this is kind of weird. Like, there was a time when the idea of even making one comic was like a dream for me, and now it's not. I don't know, it sounds weird. Like, we were talking about this the other day. It's not that it's anticlimactic now. It's just like, oh, we've done another issue. You know, yeah. It's weird. Like, every issue is wonderful, and we love it to bits. But as soon as it's done, we have to think about the next one.
Are you searching for the next high?
That's a problem, and you have to keep escalating because it's like it never hits that immediate the initial excitement. But yeah. No, we're really proud of it, and the wheel keeps on turning, and we've just got to get it ready for the next project. So
definitely,
that's good. We're expecting that back from the printer probably start of next week. Actually,
I definitely want to delve into that a bit more because I actually love your magazine, and I love your Patreon campaign. So, and we would like to do something similar, but we just haven't made it work yet. So
we haven't quite cracked Patreon, though.
No, oh, well, tell me. Look, I could. Please. If I can talk wax lyrical about that, I'd love to, because I don't think if you look at the grand scheme of things, I don't think we've cracked it anyway. It's it's a fascinating, bizarre, wondrous little thing, and yeah, I'd love to have a discussion about it.
Great. Dan, how's the novel writing going?
Yeah, it's going well. We coming up to the end now of Project Lazarus, and originally when we planned them, we were heading for about 50,000 words for the novel, and looking to finish was the deadline that we set Sunday the 18th, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
So we're kind of coming up to that now, and we were settling more. I'm just about to hit 70,000 words on this book, which has taken definitely a different shape to what I was originally going for, but I've kind of just today managed to squeeze in 3,500 words.
Jesus.
Well, I've had a bit of a crap week word wise to be honest, sort of 500 words a day, which I know is good for some, but for it's letting myself down.
Do you find I mean, I'm talking to a proper writer now, you know, like pure prose, you know, none of this picture's malarkey. But do you find like, much like I was saying, like, oh, you know, we've got another issue out, that's old hat now. Do you find, oh man, I've hit 70,000 words. You know, there's a, you kind of, you forget what it was like for that one part of your life where maybe getting 1,000 words done would have been incredible. And now it's like, oh, 70,000 words, it's nothing, got to keep going.
It's a weird transition, because I think we've spoken briefly in a previous episode about the transition between working on your word counts and how to make them bigger. And yeah, definitely, I think what we're in now, we're in September. In February, I think it was, or March, I hit 80,000 words of the first draft of a different novel. And I remember that feeling of, oh my God, this is amazing. I've hit, you know, 80,000. It's like absolutely insane. And now, yeah, I'm coming up to 70,000 words just going, yeah, book's nearly done. And it's, yeah, it's definitely a different feeling, but I think it's nice because it feels more comfortable knowing that you can reach it and that it's, I guess it's almost, yeah, it's comfortable in it not being as special anymore, I guess.
Yeah. You've got to try and balance that excitement with the challenge of the next thing whilst trying to remain grateful for the fact that you're able to do that thing. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And it's actually a word that I came across a couple of weeks ago, which sums it up perfectly. And I think it actually sums up my personality. Have you guys heard of hedonistic adaptation?
No, I haven't. No.
No. So I think
they're their first album.
Yeah. I think it goes for a lot of creatives where hedonistic adaptation basically means that you ride a high and then you adapt to that high very quickly and it becomes the norm and then it's nothing anymore. And then you are looking for that next thing.
But that's a weird thing. I mean, I've often felt, he said, putting on his pretentious hat now, but I've often felt that like, you know, when you have these ideas in your head and you're like, for the longest time had these ideas and I never did anything about them, but I was always kind of, you know, thinking about doing them. And in my head, they were this, you know, wonderful, kind of perfect, unobtainable thing. But then the moment you start making it a reality, like the moment you start forcing yourself and you're training your brain like a muscle, or you're training your willpower and you say, I'm going to sit down today, I'm going to do 500 words, I'm going to do 500 words. And it's weird because you can't help but lose just a tiny bit of the magic, which is simply the act of taking it out of your brain where it will forever be perfect and unobtainable and flawless, and exposing it to the world. And then you find the flaws, you find the things you have to fix, you get knackered because you're doing 1,000 words a day for like 8 months or something like that. Yeah. And it's like, or whatever, you know, whatever is a realistic word, like target. But you know, it's interesting. Yeah. And it's like everything we're saying, like it becomes a point where it is, if not a job, like a livelihood, you are just writing constantly. And you forget how kind of amazing that is in a weird way. It's when someone comes along and goes, you've written a book. Or like, you know, even if you've written a short story, you've written a chapter, a great paragraph. That's kind of incredible. And you get these moments where you stop and you think, yeah, actually, that is kind of incredible.
Yeah, sometimes you need someone else to remind you of that. I remember when I started making films and stuff a while ago, and I remember like sending scripts around and no one would read them and no one really cared. And I was feeling a bit down about it. And I remember thinking, how cool would it be if someone emailed me after seeing a film and would have said that they would have enjoyed it? And the first time that happened, I was like, I was amazed. I was so joyful that it happened. And then the 2 years later down the line, I was like working on some more stuff. I was a bit more well known. And I got the same sort of email from someone else. And I instantly just sort of moved on and sort of moved past it. And then my girlfriend, who's my fiance now, said, you know, 2 years ago, you would have been so happy about that, but like you don't appreciate it anymore.
Yeah, I think
I know, I was just gonna say it's a strange sensation. I still get it sometimes with driving, which I know is obviously different, but when I was learning to drive, I grew up in, well, around Cambridgeshire, out in the middle of the Fens, and it was sort of 25 miles to my friend's house. So when I learned to drive, that was awesome. That was the best feeling I could have, that feeling of freedom and moving about. And I'll sometimes get in that where I'll be driving along and go, this is a bit boring. Hold on. Like you were killing yourself for this kind of freedom. And then you just take it for granted now.
Yeah. I was thinking about that just the other day. It was so weird. I remember like a vividly when I was a very young lad, I thought, I couldn't wait to drive because this walking around is the mugs. Like I want something. I want to propel myself with no effort. And it seems so magical. And now it's just like, oh yeah, the car.
Yeah.
You know, it's so
tired of feet now. Give me wheels.
Yeah.
You know, I guess it's chasing that high. Like it would have to be like learning to fly a plane or something. And then the moment you learn to fly a plane, you'd be like, oh, it's a bit.
Do you reckon that magic does go? Because, you know, flying a plane is something substantial. That's crazy. Do you reckon there are pilots that are just like, oh, I'm in a plane again?
it's weird, isn't it? Because it's like, it's one of our greatest strengths and weaknesses as a species that we can adapt to things. You know, it's like if something terrible happens to you, if you have like a terrible sadness, it's like you should, you know, like feeling it is important because you feel it and you're acknowledging that loss or that pain or whatever bad thing happened to you, but it will heal. This is the horrible thing. You know, you think like, I feel bad now, but I will feel better. And then with every moment that you feel better and as time passes, that terrible thing fades and you think, oh, but I want to hang on to it. I want to, in a weird way, I want to honor that bad thing. And it's the same with good things as well.
Yeah.
Because if the sheer joy of, say, to bring it back to writing, if the sheer joy of finishing a chapter filled you with the most tremendous energy that you had to run around the block every time you did it, you'd never get any work done. So your brain, almost as a defense mechanism, scabs over and says, you know, yeah, this is incredible. Like every sentence I get on the page is like a mini miracle, but no, I'm just not going to think about it. I'm just going to, I can't. It's like a survival mechanism. I can't think about how cool it is.
Oh, this is getting deep. This is blowing my brain.
It's getting deep. Sorry. Yeah, I've only had like two copies today.
It reminds me of when you give a dog a toy and then wait till they've sort of gotten used to it and they've dropped it on the floor and then try to take the toy away, they suddenly realize what they're missing out on now.
Yes.
Or to take a phone away, like an iPhone away from someone now to make them realize how...
From like a teenager.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Cool.
One last little, just thinking about the perspective thing. I remember, I think it was in like 2012 and it was the first time I'd ever gone to Kapow Comic Con. And it's actually the last time I ever went to Kapow Comic Con because it was a short-lived show. But I remember I'd gone down the day before. I'd crashed in my dad's apartment, so I was sitting in this apartment all on my own. He wasn't there, and I had this box of books with me. And I had two books at this point, and I was very excited about it. Or maybe it was 2013. Anyway, long story short, I'm sitting there alone in this apartment. All I've got to do is get a night's sleep and then get on a train very early in the morning. And I go to a corner shop and I buy a couple of, you know, a little 4-pack of beers. So it's very, you know, it's very sad. I'm sitting alone in an apartment drinking beer, kind of looking at these books. And it took the alcohol blood content of two beers for me to realize how cool it was that I'd made two books. you know what I mean? Like I've got so kind of everyday about it. I'd never even stopped to smell the roses and everything stopped to think, oh yeah, this is cool, you know. Yeah. And it probably looks so pathetic from the outside, like me just kind of like kneeling, surrounded by paper, empty
That's
beer
a great
cans.
Advert for the next beer commercial.
Yeah, yeah.
Just a creative sat there just honouring his books by being completely inebriated.
Weeping, wearing like a faux tunic, kind of sewn together out of tape and versos.
I think, in all honesty, I think it is very important to celebrate your wins as much as possible. Like, we do take it for granted. When you publish your book for the second time, it's not as big a thing. So you need to take the moment to reflect and just smile at your own work. You've got to.
Yeah, 100%.
Cool.
You'd go mad.
You would, yeah. So, sorry, just to move things along, we need to do our big whoops for the week.
Oh, what a big whoop.
So, Dan, do you want to go first or should we make our guests
go
first?
Yeah, sure. I can take it unless John wants to go first.
No, please.
Awesome. Okay. So I finally got around this week to playing Uncharted 4, which I don't know if you guys are familiar with the series, the Uncharted series.
I know many people who love it.
I'm the same as John. Yeah. I've seen the trailers.
Okay. Yeah, so the kind of sum up that I give people is it's kind of like a male Tomb Raider, but when I bought my PS3 years ago, Uncharted 2 was one of the free games that came with it, and it was one of those that I gave it a bit of a chance and thought, you know, it's going to be all right, I'll see what it's all about, because I was never that crazed on that type of game, and was just blown away by the story, the movements, how advanced it was at the time for a PS3 game. And then a couple of years later, Uncharted 3 came out and blew that out of the water and was absolutely incredible. And yeah, Uncharted 4 came out a couple of months ago, and I've been meaning to play it since, just because it's one of the first games in, I think since The Last of Us, it's got like 10 out of 10 in most of its reviews. And I've played about 2 hours of gameplay, and I can so see why it's got 10 out of 10 reviews. It is, oh, it's visually magnificent. And I don't use that word a lot. That's not a damn word. It's visually, it is absolutely beautiful. And it has a really nice balance of actual gameplay and story. The story in it is so rich, and it's so, because it's the final one in the season, it's the final in the series, the final one they're doing. They paid a lot of attention to nostalgia and to bringing about this whole feeling that they're wrapping it up. And it's, yeah, just I've kind of been blown away by it. And there are so many nice touches in there, because it's like, I don't want to spoil things for people, but they got really cool Easter eggs because it's a Naughty Dog production, and they've done some other bits here and there. And
I think you'd be fine to spoil it, Dan. Are you talking about a Crash Bandicoot?
I was going to ask about the Crash Bandicoot.
I saw something about it. It looked really cool.
Yeah, I had no idea that was going to be a thing. It's quite early on in the game, but it's the main character, Nathan, and a character called Eleanor, and they're having a bit of a, you know, a lover's discussion, shall we say. And it's like, oh, will you do the dishes? I'll bet you this. And you suddenly are plunged into this level on Crash Bandicoot. And I was sat there going, this is amazing. If my 8-year-old self could see this. But yeah, I've still got a lot to play on it, but it's just one of the most visually appealing. Story-wise, it blows everything else I've played out of the water, and I'm looking forward to seeing where else it goes with it.
It's kind of sad that that's the last one in the series, because you don't often get game characters that iconic anymore, do you know what I mean? So there isn't many more Nathan Drakes or Lara Crofts or Crash Bandicoots anymore, or it didn't seem to be that way.
I know what you mean. Like, you know, that guy is my favorite character. You know, the Caucasian with the short brown hair and big gun and power armor. I love that guy.
It's a very Game of Thrones effect, isn't it? It's, you know, that show, that part with, you know, the character with the beard, and he talks to the girl. I don't think anyone knows more than two character names in Game of Thrones.
It's probably, that's probably a defense mechanism. You don't want to get too attached.
Yeah.
Oh, no. But yeah, that's my big whoop.
Great. John, how about you?
This is unplanned. I'm hoping between the three of us, we might be able to get like all main forms of media. But if this is ridiculous, I'm about to hold up a book on a podcast, which is not amazingly visual medium. I turned 30 a couple of weeks ago.
Congratulations.
Oh, thank you kindly. And one of my presents was The Greatest Cases of Sherlock Holmes, which is in a lovely kind of faux, like that kind of fake rubbery leather cover. And it's very nice. And to my eternal shame, I'd never actually read a Sherlock Holmes story.
I haven't either, by the way. I've been to his house, which doesn't make sense to me. How can there be a house if he's fictional? But I've still not read a story, and I really want to.
Yeah, well, I bought the collection 2 years ago, and I've still not read any of them.
Well, this is the interesting thing, because the only Sherlock Holmes story I'd ever actually read was the Neil Gaiman A Study in Emerald.
Yeah.
Which is it was written for a Lovecraftian Sherlock Holmes anthology.
Oh, interesting.
It's kind of brilliant, actually. And and that was the only research I did when I wrote a Sherlock Holmes story in the first Afterlife Inc. book. So I feel like a fraud, really. But so I'm reading some Sherlock Holmes, and I'm a couple of stories into this anthology. It's not chronological. It just kind of handpicked some of his greatest cases. And the thing I found really interesting is actually how, I don't want to say mundane, but how kind of down to earth a lot of them are.
Right.
And we're used to Sherlock Holmes. And I think, frankly, because of like the recent, you know, Guy Ritchie movies, which I do actually like, and the BBC series, we've come to this idea that Sherlock Holmes now is kind of like a mutant.
Yeah.
Like he's basically Charles Xavier. And when in reality, like a lot of the cases he's solved so far are rather simple, actually. Like I've been able to see where he's going, and I'm not a detective genius. But I actually want to do a small reading, if that's okay.
Of course.
I'm going to be very, very literary.
Yeah.
Because it's only don't worry, I'm not going to get Jack and Ori on you. It's only it's only a couple of paragraphs, but he does have a wonderful turn of phrase, because old Arthur Conan Doyle. And so after this particularly not especially complex mystery called The Adventure of the Red-Headed League, which is all about gentlemen with red hair, it just closed on this little quote where Watson just says, like, oh, you did a good job, Holmes, you know, and I'm paraphrasing. And Holmes just goes, it saved me from ennui, he answered, yawning. Alas, I already feel it closing in upon me. My life is spent in one long effort to escape from the commonplaces of existence. These little problems help me to do so. And you are a benefactor of the race, said I. That's Watson. That's my Watson voice. He shrugged his shoulders. Well, perhaps, after all, it is of some little use, he remarked. L'homme, c'est rien. L'ouvre, c'est tout. That's my French accent. As nice. Gustave Flaubert wrote to George Sand. And wow. I remember thinking, what an ending. And I looked at that quote, because I have no idea what Gustave Flaubert wrote to George Sand. And in English, that means the man is nothing, the work is everything.
And wow.
Okay.
That was a really cool. And I just like, oh, wow. Yeah, I can see why these were popular. He's a good writer. He was a good writer.
Yeah, time. Absolutely.
So you've gone for like a literary sort of idea there. My big whip is I got a comic book through the door the other day called Bum Apple Freak Show. And it's like, so about a year ago, I got a package from a friend. He said, it's like a list of cut out words and then some instructions that said, pick out six of the words and then write a surrealist Dadaist story based around those random words. So I did sort of sent it back to him, and now he's taken it away and he's created this mental anthology of Dadaist stories called Bum Apple Freak Show. And it's not available yet. I think it's going to be £5. I think I might get a few and bring them to the Lincoln, Dan, you know, for the Comic Con.
That'll be cool. Yeah.
Just because we haven't got any other comics really. but it's just really, really interesting to see how stories, like, even without any logic, can kind of work and kind of be funny and interesting. My story in there is about a guy moving to London and meeting a pet mustache. There's another story, the Bum Apple Freak Show, the title story. I only got halfway through it last night, but he has like an apple tree growing out of his bum, and then he starts selling and eating the apples off of the tree. It's mental, but it's really, really cool. I'll throw a link to that in the show notes so people can check it out. But yeah, it's interesting anyway. Maybe we should do one on the show at some point, Dan. Get him on. We'll write a story off the cuff.
Yes, that would be fun.
Kind of like free association.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm getting huskier over here. I'm just going to clear my throat. Sorry.
No, it was a reading. I thought you were getting into a Benedict Cumberbatch sort of tone there. Cool. Okay, so John, let's dive into you, both figuratively and literally,
and emotionally, I would hope.
So I first found Big Punch Studios. I think Niche was on another podcast, the Awesome Comics Podcast, and then from there.
Sorry, I love. Can we call him Niche from now on? That would be fantastic.
How do you pronounce his name?
Nick.
Why did I call him Niche? Is it spelled a little bit weird?
Oh, we call him all kinds of things. I call him Angle just to annoy him. So, or Angle Poise, which has been oddly fitting recently.
So anyway, Niche, Nick was on the podcast, and I just checked out the website. And I was like, oh, this is very interesting. I like that they've got lots of stuff going up. It's not just one medium. And then I started to look at your Patreon campaign, started to look at the comic books, and I was kind of amazed and blown away by like the variety of stuff you're doing. I mean, how did it all start?
Well, that's incredibly kind of you to say so. And this is coming from the amazing Hawk and Cleaver website, which I think is truly fantastic, having browsed it. But yeah, where did it all begin? Well, I'll try and keep this concise because I know I have a tendency to ramble. But I always wanted to make comics. Mm. And I had this kind of dream or this idea that the way you made comics was you wrote a script, one take, that's, you know, printed it off, walked up to a comic convention, waving it above your head and said, I've made a story. Who wants to publish it? And then like you'd hear like I sir, you know, a little someone would pop up at the back, and it'd be like an auction. And then the next step was success and fame and everything. And I just realised rather quickly as a young lad that just wasn't going to happen. So I rather than kind of wait for that magical like fairy godmother effect, I ended up starting to publish a comic myself, which was never my intention. I never set out to be a self-publisher.
How old were you at this point? Sorry.
Oh, sorry. I was saying lad. I was...
I'm picturing like a seven-year-old boy.
No, it's true. I went to my first convention in 2005, and I was 18 or 19.
Okay.
And yeah. I had the most teenage story you've ever imagined. It was called Dark Force, and it was, shall we say, gnarly. There were a lot of chains and spikes and angels and demons. Oh, and
sounds radical.
It was pretty bodacious, actually. And I want to bring it back at some point. I really do. And but yeah, it was like it was born out of the 90s comics. It was very Joe Mad. It was very X-Men. And and I just very kindly, I have to say, spoke to people and kind of got put in my place. And I mean this in the best possible way. Like I learned, you know, this is how you do this, that, or the other. But flash forward, started making a couple of comics that didn't really go anywhere. 2007, I had an idea for a comic called Afterlife Inc., which is about a con artist who died, discovered an afterlife in chaos, then took over and ran it like a business. That was 2007. It took me until 2011 to start getting content together, because that was like, I got a job, I was like saving up, I got a bit of money to pay artists. And I started touring. I went around a load of conventions in 2011 just as a punter. And this time I was kind of like armed mentally, not kind of physically, but I was ready. I was kind of like, I want to learn this time. I want to go and talk to people. And I didn't go to the publishers such as there weren't many in the UK. I went to the indie people and I said, you know, the bog standard questions. Where did you get a tablecloth? You know, how'd you book a table? Where'd you get these banners from? Who printed your books? And I was putting together some content at this time. And I remember going to a Birmingham convention and stopping by, going around the tables, and there was a gentleman called
Niche
Angel who was selling his comic called Seven String. It's about a world where music is magic and people fight with guitar swords and stuff. And it was really just a passing encounter. There wasn't, you know, it wasn't like this great meeting of the minds. But I remember saying, what's all this about then? And he opened his comic and he showed me this great big double page spread of the gods of this world, there were seven gods, and each god embodied a different genre of music. And there was a rock god, there was a folk god, there was like an electro god. And
that
I think
that
sounds
incredible.
Yes, exactly. And I, this story has morphed over the years, but I think I swore at him then and there. I was like, oh, damn you. Yeah, I'm being polite now. I was like, you swine. That's just such a good idea. Like, I was annoyed at him. And bought his book and we parted ways. And then in start of 2012, I actually had a book to sell. I had the first volume of Afterlife Inc. We went to London Super Comic Con and I started selling it, my first ever show. And I had no idea how it was going to go, but I saw Niche, waved at him. He bought a copy of my book. And I learned after the fact that he'd forgotten me. He had no idea who I was that second time around. But I'd written him a really nice email after I bought Seven String. And I said, oh, I love your book, man. It's amazing. It's really inspiring. You're doing all this world building. That's kind of what I want to do. And he wrote me a really gushing email after he bought my book, but he didn't remember me. He hadn't kind of put two and two together. And then eventually like it kind of clicked and we were like, oh, hang on. And then we just started bumping into each other at shows, always ended up chatting. Our kind of significant others all met each other. So Ali, Nick's other half, Lucy, my other half. And the four of us clearly hit it off, because after like the second or third time we were hanging out after a show, we were eating sushi. And Nick just said, do you want to come on holiday with us? It was this really bizarre leap. And we ended up going up to like his parents' place up in Yorkshire, and we spent like a week hanging out there.
You met the parents pretty early on in the relationship then. I like it.
Yeah, as you're guessing. Yeah, well, you see, as you might, you know, the subtext, you might be able to read between the lines here, is that this is the love that dare not speak its name between me and Niche. And yeah, but the four of us just really hit it off, and we started, you know, specifically requesting that our tables be next to each other at shows. We decided to do a crossover between Seven String and Afterlife Inc., which we called the Heavenly Chord, and we did it as a joke at first. We were like, oh, wouldn't it be funny if we took the mick out of the end of Iron Man 2 where they find the hammer out in the desert? Because Nick's Seven String revolves around the eponymous Seven String, this incredible guitar sword. And we had a laugh, and then we thought, what if we did it? Like, what's actually stopping us? And we made it. That's the incredible thing. And it was, to date, one of the most enjoyable things I've ever done, like, as a creative project. It was a laugh riot from beginning to end. And I'm still so proud of it as a story. I think it, he said biased, but I think it really works as a standalone. But we left it in canon.
Mm.
That's the thing. Like, literally through the events of the story, an item from Nick's world is left behind in mine.
That's pretty
and
cool.
And kind of like, well, I will wrap this up a second, because I know I've talked like about repetition, hesitation, and deviation for like 5 minutes. But long story short is, we had inadvertently created a multiverse. And the thing that Nick and I had in common was that we were both world builders, and we both had a big mythology outside the, you know, a couple of stories we published, which tied together our works. And, you know, it may take us, I think we'd each originally planned that if it took us a decade or if it took us 20 years, we would eventually tell all these stories and it would all tie together. And we just decided to merge them. And we're like, why? We've shown that these two worlds are in a multiversal capacity next to each other. Why don't we do this? And we went from, you know, the Heavenly Chord is what scarred it all. We became a collective. Then we became a limited company. And then we properly just said, like, Lucy and Ali are part of this as well. Like, because they were so much part of this. It wasn't just me and Nick. And then the four of us, we were all storytellers. We all believed in creating these big worlds. And the next thing you know, we're all partners in our own little company. And
it's,
I guess, the rest is history.
It's amazing. I mean, it sort of rings true to what my experience has been like with Hawk and Cleaver, in the sense of, it started out as just like a little collective where we'd read each other's work and stuff like that, and then suddenly became something bigger when we realized that it's more fun, like, working with other people generally.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I've found that completely as well. I was working alone, probably not as long as I think you've been a creative, Luke, but in the last, it must be coming up to a year now that I've been part of Hawk and Cleaver. It's just so nice having people there and being around other people that share what you do and the processes that you go through. And on a side note, I really want to have that as my LinkedIn sort of update, saying something like Daniel Wilcox inadvertently creating multiverses. Or put that on your gravestone, because that's a line to follow you to death, isn't it?
Yeah.
Thank you. That's very kind. I feel that will be the, I was going to say something very poetic there, but, you know, it's both a wonderful and a terrible thing. This is what will be hanging over me for the rest of my life now. And we've often joked about, we're going to finally wrap up all our stories and we'll all be 70 and by no means richer, but a lot more wrinkled. And we're like, it's finally over. Now the success. Now we rake in the...
now money and bridge.
The next step is profit. But, I mean, seriously, though, it's a very... I mean, like, you know, it's wonderful to create stuff, but it can be quite a lonely profession otherwise. And having a few friends just to share your woes with is lovely, you know.
What's the working relationship in the sense?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com. I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
So does one of you take on more of like the printing admin type stuff and one of you do social media, or how do you divvy that up?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess kind of as a kind of grander scope of everything we do now, we publish BPM quarterly, and BPM collects four titles from that multiverse we've kind of mentioned. So it's all tying together. It's all bigger things. We do our graphic novels. We've done our first card game and we do some podcasts. So obviously we have enough to keep us busy. And of course, we all have day jobs. Like this isn't actually, this isn't actually, we're not sitting on our towers of gold
yet.
Is the thing, but yeah, it's so how do we divvy it up? Well, I mean, we joke about it, but Nick is like our star, I'm sorry, I'm not sporty, our star trisman. Like he's the one who scores the points with the ball, and I sometimes feel like we're, oh my god, this is the worst American football analogy ever. I think we are the quarterback who is throwing the ball so Nick can score. So we often, like, because Nick draws like so much of our output, and because that is incredibly time consuming, we feel like we clear as much space as we can so Nick can run for the goal. So it's basically like if Nick can draw, then we've kind of succeeded. But I think it's actually divvied up quite well, because Lucy keeps everyone in check, which is wonderful. So Lucy does writing. We co-write. Me and her co-write 99 Swords. She letters, so she letters all our stuff. She also looks after all our mailing lists and subscriptions. So she kind of interacts with our subscribers and patrons and fans. Nick does the drawing, but he's also pretty much our convention guy as well. Like he's pretty good at talking with MCM and the shows and booking tables or booths and whatnot. Ali is our film wizard and our kind of multimedia person. So she's really good at that. And she's also handling our social media as well. So she's getting very, and also like, you know, she's saying, oh, we should try like Pinterest or Imgur and stuff like that. And I'm like, what the hell are these young people apps? I don't understand them. And also Ali is kind of been leading the charge on our gaming side of things as well. So she's talking to gaming publishers and printers about finding a home for Sandwich Masters, which is our card game. And then I guess my role is, I think I do the majority of the writing. I'm also, I guess, our head editor. I work as an editor in my day job. I am the king of commas. Like I'm basically just running through everything we write with a comma shotgun and just spattering it with that. I write copy for magazine, and I tend to tweet and do some Facebooking as well. And I tend to do the finances as well. So, and at some point we all sleep as well.
Yeah, some
I don't
point,
know.
Yeah.
I don't know when.
Dan, like, does this sound like kind of familiar in the sense of the amount of work that goes into doing something like this? Because we're working day jobs in a minute as well, and trying to,
yeah.
Like, I was up at 5 this morning trying to get some words in and stuff. And
jeez, you beat me. I was 5:30.
Yeah,
slacker. Yeah,
but it's just it's the only way to get things done. I mean, if I kind of feel like it's one of those one on one makes three kind of situations where the sort of the brand, if you could call it a brand, is is a lot bigger than when I was working on my own. It was so difficult to just get myself out there, stay on top of all this stuff. But when you've got different people to work and concentrate on different areas, it just seems to multiply the output and the awareness so much.
Yeah, and I think we're still relatively young. We're still, in a lot of senses, finding our feet with things. But we're definitely, from how I see it, falling into patterns and rhythms of who is sort of more suited to what. So, I mean, the way I see it, Matt's just fantastic at ploughing on with gory writing things, and he's got a bit of a hand at some creepy design stuff, which is incredible. Ben's pretty decent at the graphic design side and making sort of the branding stuff look really pretty and nice. I'd like to think mine's in compiling books and a bit of the proofing as well, and then yours is a mixture of audio and video and writing and kind of everything as well. But yeah, it's organically finding its feet in what we do for each other and how we help each other. But it's nice to kind of have that advantage of saying to someone, oh, you're better at this, can you do this? So for example, last night I spent a couple hours putting together Matt Butcher's new book, because he's not put anything to print yet, or he's not formatted it himself, and I've got experience in doing that, so happy to help where I can.
And if you would do mine as well, because I hate doing that stuff.
Yeah, and I'm working on yours next week, because I really want to see yours in print, just purely because the cover's so beautiful.
Oh, thank you. So you've got, I really want to touch on Sandwich Masters, because it's...
Okay.
I really would love to do some sort of game at some point, but I don't feel like I game enough to have a good...
The Edge.
The Edge, yeah.
Well, it's any consolation. I'm not very good at Sandwich Masters. I don't know if that makes it the sign of a good game, but I lose so often at that game. It's crazy.
So can you tell us a little bit about what Sandwich Masters is for the listeners, and where the project started and how you funded it?
Certainly. I mean, certainly because I clearly love the sound of my own voice. We were in a car journey, one of the many kind of holidays or trips we spent to visit each other back when we were all living in different cities, because Nick and Ali were down in Salisbury, Lucy and I were in Cheltenham, and
whereabouts are you now? Sorry, just to...
we're all in Cheltenham.
Okay,
cool. All right. the hub of the Southwest, where everything happens. And but no, we were visiting Nick's brother, who lives down in Brighton, and we were... Very long car journey. The four of us were packed in and we were starving. We were just like trapped in this car, in a traffic jam. We were really hungry and we just started riffing on sandwiches, like just coming up with nonsense. And it was something as simple as, because I mean, I guess I should clarify, like we're all gamers, as in board games. Like we would play so many card and board games all the time. I guess the one sad thing about Big Punch is that we actually have less time to do that now. We need to make more time for it. But we were always playing stuff, and it was a big part of us all getting to know each other, was just like trying out a new board game. And so it was very much on our mind, and we just kind of said, wouldn't it, like, sandwich ingredients are flat, right? You know, they're all kind of like two-dimensional. Cards are also two-dimensional. We said, like, what if you were building a sandwich game, like a game, and by stacking cards? And we just started joking about it. And I think the initial idea was, we were talking about having health inspectors, and you were using, like, if you use subpar ingredients, you'd get in trouble and there'd be a fine. But then I had this idea that if you slipped money, if you put like a £20 note in the sandwich and just kind of slowly slid it across the table to the inspector. And so, yeah, we just started coming up with really stupid ideas. But we thought it would work. It was one of those kind of like, because it's simple. I mean, ultimately, like, it's just, you're just building runs or kind of like collections. It'd be great. And then, like all good ideas, we didn't do anything with it. It just kind of went on back burner. And I remember, it was, if not a year, then at least 6 months later, I was in my previous day job, where I worked as a school biology technician. And because I'm a biologist by training, not a rightist. And I just was slacking off and I started thinking, well, hang on, this is maths. Like, this is basic mathematics, working out like sandwich combinations and stuff. So I started browsing the Wikipedia page for sandwiches. And there is a list of like 100 different sandwiches. And I started going through them and listing all the ingredients. And if there's one thing I love more than cold Vulkan logic. It's it's Excel spreadsheets. So I built an Excel spreadsheet and I started saying, like, what are the basic ingredients? So we'd have like cheese, ham, egg, lettuce going on like that. And so I came up with like 20 sandwiches, like famous, you know, real sandwiches, like ham and cheese, that kind of thing. And I thought, okay, so ham and cheese would be two bread cargs, one cheese and one ham. And I worked out this mathematical formula basically saying, like, if we have a deck, which is however many cargs, this is how much bread we need, this is how much cheese. And we said this one summer, which I think was summer of 2013, or maybe later, it's all blurring into one now, we're going to lock ourselves in a house for like 3 days over a summer, and we're not going to emerge until we have a working prototype of this game. So we bought tons of blank white cards from Ryman's, pencils, and we just started scribbling it down, and we did nothing but playtest this game. And it very quickly evolved, and we very quickly scrapped the initial idea of putting money in sandwiches. But we eventually came up with a working game, which was called Sandwich Masters. And the gimmick, just to kind of get the gameplay nailed down here, is that you have order cards, which are dealt onto the table, and there's very little text on them. It's all symbol-based. And kudos to Nick and Ali here, because Nick was able to put all the art elements together, and Ali designed and arranged for cards, and it looked lovely. But yeah, it's basically just image and image association. So, you know, a sandwich comes down, it's called the meat sweats, and it's like you need one of every type of meat. So red cards are meat, yellow cards are dairy, blue cards are condiments, and green cards are salad. And then within those, you've got like bacon, ham, chicken, beef, sausage. So you just start building your sandwiches, and then you start with bread, you stack up the ingredients, you've got a hand of ingredients, and then when you're ready, you close it and you collect your money. But the catch is that every good ingredient has an evil counterpart. So, for example, you have beef, a lovely bit of sliced beef, and you have raw beef, which is a cow. And the idea is that the customer is so hungry, they will eat anything. So the moment you close that sandwich and put the final piece of bread on, you're safe. But every moment your sandwich is open and it has evil ingredients in, it means that you are at risk of a health inspector. So if someone plays a health inspector card in front of you and you've got evil ingredients in it, you either have to bribe the health inspector or throw the sandwiches away.
Huh.
And the final aspect is you have attack condiments, which are ingredients you can play in other people's sandwiches to ruin them. So we all picked one for the original deck, and it was glass. A sneeze, a ghost, and a lady's silk glove, which was my favourite. and we found a printer just down the road. It was not a printer who had ever actually printed a card game before, but we actually went for the convenience of having someone 3 miles from our door, at least to get like a prototype made. We did lots of beta testing with our friends. We booked out a cafe in town, invited about 30 people along, and we said, hey, everyone, if you turn up, we're going to be filming some footage of people playing the game, getting feedback. And
is this the video on the Patreon page?
Yes, it is indeed, okay. Which is what we used on our Kickstarter projects as well.
Yeah.
And it was amazing, and people had a great time, and people just seemed to get it and instinctively.
Yep.
And we even roped in... There was like a church group who were there who we'd ended up filling the top half of this restaurant cafe thing. And they were just kind of marooned in the middle of it by all these random people. And they said, what are you doing? And I said, oh, we're testing this card game. And they were like, well, can we play? So we got them in as well and got a few testimonials from them. And this was all in preparation for our Kickstarter, which we ran last September and successfully funded it. So we were able to do a print run.
How many Kickstarter campaigns have you guys done?
I personally have run. Okay. Oh, hang on. Right. I ran two myself before we became Big Punch. Nick ran two himself. We did Sandwich Masters, which was our first Big Punch one, and I'm currently running another one at the moment. So we've done six between us.
And what is the success rate on your campaigns?
Oh, well, I could go into this in great detail, but we've succeeded on them all, which is nice. Probably the two biggest runaway successes we had were the collected hardback editions we did. So I did The Book of Life, which was a hardback collecting volumes 1, 2, and 3 of Afterlife Inc. And that hit 60% in the first day and was funded in 5. So I think we made like something like 200. Well, I think we were asking for like 3 grand and we made like 8, which was great. And then we set, but it's also like Sandwich Masters, as an interesting aside, Sandwich Masters was kind of struggling on Kickstarter. And in fact, I could probably talk for hours on this and I'll try not to, but we've noticed that Kickstarter has become a bit harder, I would say, in recent years, because it's become, I don't want to use the word commercial, but it kind of has become a bit more commercial, where now you're getting these very polished projects running and they have a whole marketing team behind them. They're by larger companies and it's getting a little harder, I would say, for the guy in his bedroom running a dream project to make it happen. And as a fine example, Sandwich Masters was struggling. We did quite well in the first week, then it slowed right down and we were at, you know, we were coming up on our third week and I thought, I seriously don't think we're going to make this. Like, it was really slowing down. And then out of the blue, we woke up one morning and pledges were going through the roof and we couldn't work out what had happened. And Kickstarter themselves had made us project of the day. Out of everything on Kickstarter. And we made more in that day than we'd made in the entire 3 weeks previous. And we ended up going well over our target and we were able to hit a few stretch goals and print more than we'd hoped for and do 2 expansion packs. But it was wonderful. But of course, it's a scenario you entirely can't plan for. Like, if Kickstarter hadn't just plucked us out of obscurity, I don't think we would have made it.
That's a pretty impressive, like, strike rate out of all of your campaigns in general though. I mean, what do you think is different about your campaigns to other campaigns that might not work so well?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I feel I've personally learnt a lot. I remember back when they announced, because Kickstarter came to the UK, it opened up to UK projects in October 2012, I want to say. And I remember that vividly because we heard it was coming and a lot of people, a lot of my friends in like the indie comics area were saying like, oh, great, I'm going to run a Kickstarter. And I'd been panicking, like losing my mind, thinking, how the hell am I going to make my third book? Because it's expensive, you know, paying everyone involved, because I wanted to pay all the artists involved. And it's a big book. And how am I going to do this? And I thought, could I do a Kickstarter? And I was like, no, only like talented people run Kickstarters. Like, I'm never going to be able to do this. And I thought, like, why not? Like, I'm no, like, my case is no more or less worthy than anyone else's. I should give it a shot. So, inspired by everyone, all my friends who talked about it, I started putting a project together. And I launched it on the day that UK projects went live. It went live, I think, on Halloween 2012. And everyone who'd been talking about doing it hadn't got round to it yet. So I ended up being the joint first UK comic project on Kickstarter, along with Kate Ashwin, who does this amazing webcomic called Widdershins.
I think I've heard of Widdershins, yeah.
Oh, yeah, Kate's amazing. Like, you know, she does a Kickstarter every year for the collected edition of a webcomic every year, and she just utterly dominates every year. So she's got that down. But yeah, I completely made a mess of my rewards when my first Kickstarter. Like, it was a real, I completely structured it wrong. I thought to myself, what rewards can I give people? And I was like, I can give people badges. It'd be like a little blister pack of 7 badges, all the main characters. I could give people a print. And I thought, oh, a print is better than a badge. So I should tier that above the badges. And then I thought, I can do people a t-shirt. And I thought, well, a t-shirt is better than a print. So I'll put that above that. And then I thought, and I can give them a book. And the book is better than a t-shirt. So I structured my rewards completely the wrong way around. So if you wanted the book, which would retail at like 12 quid, you had to pledge like 50 quid. And that got you the book, a t-shirt, a print, and a badge. And I'd already, I was a few days in and people were like, hey, I just want the book. Do I have to get all this other junk? And I was like, oh no, what have I done? And I couldn't go back in and change it.
Oh no.
Because once people had pledged to a reward, you can't adjust it. So a couple of people had very kindly pledged for, like, you know, the t-shirt and everything. And I thought, oh man, I've really shot myself in the foot here. And that first Kickstarter was so stressful. Like, it's a bit of a recurring thing where I fall ill every time we run a Kickstarter.
The curse of the Kickstarter.
Oh, no joke. I developed labyrinthitis after our first Kickstarter. I was so stressed, and I was ill for months afterwards.
I'm still trying to think if that's a real thing. Why is labyrinthitis?
I was running myself ragged. I got so stressed and kind of down that I got an inner ear kind of viral infection, and my head wouldn't stop spinning for months.
That's called labyrinthitis.
Yeah, because it's a little bit of your ear called the labyrinth, and it becomes inflamed. And
that's amazing.
So where the Minotaur lives, Luke.
Yeah, course, I basically had a small, bull-headed man running around the inside of my ear.
David Bowie.
I was tormented by visions of David Bowie's tight trousers in Labyrinth. And I completely made a mess of it. And somehow we limped home, and we actually made it. And just about, it was a real struggle. And I was very much dependent on the kindness of my family and friends. But we made it. And I swore that I would never make those mistakes again, and I would have a much better run campaign the next time around.
That's amazing.
What would you say your main three takeaways were from, I mean, all your Kickstarters combined? What would be three key things that, you know, listeners could listen to if they were interested in a Kickstarter that they could take forward on theirs?
Oh, certainly. Hit the ground running. So do not tell people that you are running a Kickstarter on the morning you launch it.
Mm.
So I say you want to have at least an utter minimum 2 weeks promotion beforehand. You want to be telling people, you want to be writing to review sites, you want to be running articles before it goes live. This is very important. They need to know to come and pledge, because Kickstarter is less about your overall goal and less about how much you make versus how quickly you make it. So perception of success is pivotal. So case in point, there is a project running at the moment for a comic, and I glanced across and I saw that it is 1,739% funded.
Wow.
Which is your immediate reaction. You go, oh, flipping heck, this must be the best project in the world. I should go back it right now because it's selling like hotcakes. And I looked at it again and I looked closer and I was like, how much money have they raised? And they've raised £1,739.
Oh.
So they set a target of £1.
That's interesting.
So perception of, but this is the thing, like if you hit your target earlier, you will get more money overall.
Mm.
Because no one wants to back a horse which they think is going to lose. So if you can get the funding in very quickly and secure your target nice and early, then that's grand, because people will look at a successful project and think, oh, if I pledge 10 quid to that, it's a sure bet that it will get made and I will get a nice reward out of it.
It's that whole social proof, isn't it? Whenever people seeing it doing well, they want a bit of the action. But
absolutely. No, entirely. And on that end, I would also recommend having, as a kind of like a junction to that, I would recommend having early bird rewards. So a reason to get people kind of pledging earlier. So say like the book is worth a tenner, early bird rewards, the first 20 people to get in there can get the book for like 8 quid or 7 quid or something like that. Or, you know, it's 10 quid, but you'll also get a nice hat or something like that. You know, reasons to get people pledging early. I guess that was one point. I guess another point is really, really, really do the math, as they say, because it is not a magic wand. It will not solve all your problems. And I love Excel. I love Excel spreadsheets. And I ran so many Excel spreadsheets. And I was looking at the book I'm currently funding. I've actually funded half a book myself, entirely separate from Kickstarter. Like I'm thinking, like I've put my money in. I'm hoping that people can help us go the rest of the way, because it's taken me 2 years to get that money together to get there. And but I was looking at it, and I looked at if I tried to run a Kickstarter to fund the entirety of the project, like all the money I needed to pay the artists, the print costs, Kickstarter's admin fees, and then I looked at the unit price of one book, I would have had to give away more books than I was printing to hit the target. Right. If that makes any sense. So you've really got to look at your numbers. I mean, there's so many horror stories of people who are very creative, but never sat down and thought, how do I run this as a business? How do I, I have it in me to fulfill 3,000 orders when that comes about? I mean, you don't want to, you know, be massively successful, make millions on Kickstarter, and then go, right, I need to find a printer. Or, right, I need to find a manufacturer or something like that. So, yeah.
Be prepared.
Exactly, yeah. And, of course, remember that Kickstarter will take 11% of whatever you make as well. That's how they make their money. So, you know, factor that in as well.
And I guess you've got to pay tax as well on that once it's in to your bank?
A degree of that is processed by... I mean, Kickstarter covers some of the admin and tax fees on their end. But yeah, of course, when whatever you make at the end of it, you will have to declare in your own tax returns and stuff.
Yeah.
And so I guess, sorry, I love the sound of my own voice. I'm sorry, I'm terrible.
It's very lovely, so I don't mind.
It's better than silent guest.
Yeah.
Well, it's very kind of you. Well, I will try and wrap this up. So it was hit the ground running, run the numbers beforehand, and try and get your target as your funding goal as kind of low as possible, which I know is a weird thing to say, and I know it sounds a bit counterintuitive, but if you have two projects running side by side on Kickstarter, they're both to make, say, a 50-page comic. If one project is trying to raise $3,000 and another project is trying to raise $15,000, if they both make $3,000, the lower target one is going to seem more successful.
Yeah.
So really think about your target, and does it need to be as big as it is? Because we, with Sandwich Maskers, we made a calculated risk to try and print less. So we said, what size print run do we go for? Do we go for, you know, X amount, or do we go for X times two? And if we go for X times two, we're going to need a higher Kickstarter target. It's going to be harder to hit. The perception will be that it's a slower project. But if we go for a smaller print run, we have less money to raise. Every backer is a larger percentage of our target. And there we might succeed, we might hit it quicker, and we might go over, which means we might be able to hit our second target with stretch goals. So think about that.
Great. It's we are going to be doing a Kickstarter campaign at some point, so it's good to know. Check, Dan, how are you doing for time on your side? Because it's going to be one of our longer episodes.
I will have to shoot off soon. I'm all right for a couple of minutes.
Oh, good grief. I'm so sorry, guys.
We'll have to get you back on for an episode too, because there's still a lot I really want to sort of ask you, like your podcast, for example. It'd be interesting to see, because you've got like four or five, haven't you? There seems to be quite a few.
Well, thank you. That's very kind. I mean, quantity does not equate to quality, I say. It got a bit kind of derailed this year, if only because I've been quite ill for the last 6 months. But we're getting back on it now, and we have a wonderful organizational app, which has revolutionized the everything we do. So we now have reminders when we need to record them. And I've been steadily improving my podcast rig. So we've now got quite a lean little system, which we can pop up and record at any moment. So
great.
So, I feel you are putting me to shame, though, with the general production levels and
I don't know. I mean, it's you pick things up as you go, I guess. I don't know. Say again, Dan.
And you drop things. I can't remember the last time I slept, so.
Yeah. So what we'll probably do then, if it's okay with John, we'll make this episode more about the Kickstarter campaigns, and then we'll get on for part two where we'll talk about Patreon and Big Punch Magazine and that kind of thing. Does that sound okay, John, to you?
Sounds amazing. Thank you. Yeah.
Right. So what we'll do now then, we'll jump straight into the quick fire round. Cue the little jingle there.
Quickly, please.
And Dan, have you got your questions up in front of you?
I've got them in front of me. Yeah. All the ones from Slack. Yeah.
Yeah. So, John, we're going to shoot a load of short questions. Just say whatever comes to your mind. Don't worry, it's nothing too serious. But are you ready?
That's fine. Now, I'm guessing you'd like slightly shorter answers than some of my previous ones.
You've got 5 seconds per answer.
Fine. Let's do it.
Okay, Dan, from the Slack list then, you go first.
Cool. Last thing you do before you go to bed?
Cry.
Arnold or Sylvester?
Arnold.
Cheese or yogurt?
Both.
Favorite word?
My life.
It's a difficult one.
No.
Okay.
Crying out loud. Yeah, no. Don't. Stop it.
Cue countdown jingle. Favorite book?
Oh, good grief. Angel Maker by Nick Harkaway.
Favorite film?
Pontypool.
What makes you smile?
So much, actually. I keep wanting to be depressed, but actually I find a lot of humour in weird things.
Itchy and Scratchy or Pinky and the Brain?
Itchy and Scratchy.
Sauron or Voldemort?
Oh, Sauron.
Shakespeare or Wheaton? Are we talking about Will Wheaton, Dan? Or...
Will Shakespeare or Will Wheaton?
Will Wheaton. Shakespeare, I guess.
Okay, awesome. Cool.
Great. Can I also can I say as well? So in our list of when we were coming up with these questions, Luke followed several of these questions with "What do you reckon?" And I was genuinely about to just ask you, "What do you reckon?"
You see, I like that. It gets quite deep. So what do you reckon?
I think we've proven that we can go pretty deep on these.
Oh no, you're saying like cheese or yogurt. Like if I can't build a small house out of my cheese, I'm not touching it. But the rest of Big Punch, we're talking about like Lunchables and kind of like liquid cheese and little crispy straw things, and nothing repulses me more. It's just
cottage cheese. Do you like a little?
No, it's a confused yogurt. It's not really.
It is a confused yogurt. That's the best like description of cottage cheese.
Oh no.
Okay, cool. So we're pretty gonna have to wrap up pretty soon. So John, where do you want people to go after listening to this show? I'm guessing the Kickstarter campaign, right?
I've got to say right now, if I'm being shameless, I would love people to go to Kickstarter and look up Afterlife Inc. Volume 4, Man Made God.
Cool. And there's a pledge on there which I've gone for, which is one where you get all 4 of the volumes. Is that right?
Yes, indeed. Yeah, because this is for obviously the 4th volume. And if you pick up the book, you'll get digital copies of all the previous ones, but we also done options where you can complete your collection. So you can get 2 books, 3 books, 4 books, whatever you want.
Great. Perfect. Dan, yeah, what about you? Where do you want to send people?
Send people to, we've got the new volume of The Other Stories starting on Monday, which is exciting. And the print version of seasons volumes 4 to 6 is coming out in the next few days. So that's exciting.
Cool. That, by the time this podcast goes live, I'm sure that'll be out.
They will be out, yeah.
So I'll link that in the show notes. And yeah, just go to the website, hawkandcleaver.com, and we'll get John on as soon as possible because I've got loads more questions for him.
I'm going to be like the bad penny. I'm just going to be turning up all the time.
Cool. All right, guys. Yeah, nice one. Let's reconvene.
Thank you for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
No, cheers. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, John. Take care, man.
Cheers, guys.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Story Studio podcast. Still hungering for some podcast goodness? Then why not check out our other show, The Other Stories? Oh, and did you know, every time you leave us a review in the iTunes store, a puppy is born. Cute, eh? Anyway, toodle pip.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.